This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Nima Dagbandan, the Real Estate Finance Group at Garassi LLP is managed by Nima, and he's a partner with a law firm. His practice entails all facets of lending matters across the country, including but not limited to the preparation of loan documents and addenda in all 50 states, loss mitigation efforts, preparation and negotiation of secondary market documents, including loan sales and participation agreements, line of credit, warehouse facilities, hypothecations, and securitizations. He advises financial institutions on various lending matters, including licensing, usury, and foreclosure. Mr. Bagdanin also is an expert in default management and leads the firm Non-Judicial Trustee Group. So, Nima, we welcome you to our show.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Is this connected in spirit with what Fannie and Freddie did on March 18th and just extended till June 30th?
That's right. We are in an interesting time period where you have this historically high unemployment. And I think a lot of well-meaning people are trying to figure out how to not have a calamity on our hands in particular and dealing with making sure we don't have enormous amounts of our population thrown out on the streets and kicked out of their homes and a repeat really of 2008, but on a much grander scale.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with some of the decisions and the speed of the action, to be honest with you. I really thought some of it was very important because it almost like you're on hold. We have almost a 90-day hold to see if we can get back to some normalcy without just having complete disaster.
That's right, Bruce. And I think, what's interesting this time around, and I feel like the sentiment, we represent mortgage lenders, typically non-bank mortgage lenders, private lenders, mortgage debt funds, those sorts of things. So, they've always been in this generally less regulated bucket. And I've been seriously impressed with what I would say is the national sentiment on being forgiving, entering into forbearances, and really acknowledging that this is a situation that's not, it's not your traditional default situation. It's something that was brought upon us, and I feel like they have a more self-regulation than I've ever seen before.
Yeah, I think the spirit of the group of people on both sides has been extraordinary. I have rentals myself. And some friends I have, they have management of 1,000 units or more, and well over 95% of people are paying their rent without a problem. But the people that can't pay are also being worked with by owners because they've taken time to understand the circumstance.
That's right. And similarly, I'm getting the exact same information back to us. Oftentimes, with the clients we represent, they are very much like you. So they are oftentimes either individuals or funds where the participants themselves generated their wealth through property acquisition over time and then started using that money to start lending it as well, right? So oftentimes they very much understand the real estate in a very dynamic way where they understand that there is a an underlying tenant and the tenant paying and the kind of the upward shift of what happens if the tenant pays or doesn't pay, how does that affect the landlord, how does that affect the lender? And so, it is an interesting worldview where traditionally, even through the representation of a mortgage lender, I have oftentimes not had to focus as much on the tenant-landlord relationship, but you are really seeing both sides of it play out there.
What's difficult about a situation like this is when, let's say you invested in a loan. You invested in a loan under a set of rules that you thought would probably not change.
Yes.
And all of a sudden now you've got you could have a moratorium on your payments enforced. And that's just something that probably didn't occur to anybody that owns a loan.
That's right. And if I can, you know, the interesting aspect of this as well is, and I know we're going to be jumping to the legislation here, is in my experience when speaking with legislators, they don't really understand that this industry, meaning in any sort of non-bank lending, exists. And if they, and to the degree it exists, it's irrelevant in their worldview. We had a, probably the most telling moment was I was attending the American Association of Private Lenders conference last year, and they had Barney Frank as the keynote speaker. And the name of the association is the Association of Private Lenders.
Right.
He started in his speech, which was really, it was an interesting speech on a variety of levels. He believed or understood that we were just small banks. That's what he interpreted an Association of Private Lenders to mean. He had no idea in the conversation, and like we were kind of chuckling in the room, like, this, the speaker doesn't understand who we are. And he was, you know, the chair of the finance committee. And it was really demonstrated, to your point, that you know, the ability to sustain a loss at a bank perspective, or the ability to absorb these sorts of things, is fundamentally different to your average, you know, retail investor and a loan who, you know, this is just effectively a bond fixed income product for them, right? This is, they invest in the stock market, they invest in a variety of sources. This is another investment source. And many of them, particularly those that are older, are just using this as an income source for them that they relied upon. And, you know, in a normal market, when you have a defaulted loan here or there, that's okay. They can get by. But if you were to have a complete stoppage of income, you know, you're really decimating effectively a large elderly population as part of this process.
That's right. So, you know, that's the thing, you know, as a hard money lender, you start thinking about, well, there, it comes up sometimes, okay, well, let's say you have a trustee that you own inside of a retirement plan. There was talk about having to have it appraised every year, which I thought, well, what a complete waste of time. Of course, it's worth the face value of the note. Well, now you throw in the fact that you're not collecting payments on it. Okay, wow, that's a whole different story.
Right. So, and worse, I mean, I understand the you know, the FHA. And I think the interesting world in which we live in is these private notes are very different in nature, right? I think that well, one, it's an election year, right? And so I can understand both on the national level and at the state level that legislatures do not want homeowners losing their homes during this time period. And so I can respect that, and that makes a lot of sense. And as a, you know, as a nation, we can decide whether that's appropriate and to what extent, and all of that makes sense. The legislation, particularly in California, is so illogical in its application, because they're not dividing up along any of the common lines. You know, they don't care whether these are, you know, if there was an investment loan or a spec home or you know, whether you're buying rental property. They make no delineation between why you're doing this, you know, whether it's your 60th investment property or whether it's your home, your primary residence. No distinctions being made here.
Wow.
And so they're throwing what I would say is a bazooka to a knife fight. And, you know, it's really, you know, the pendulum must swing, but in California, they're swinging very, very far, whereas the FHA was a very specific targeted program to make sure that homeowners were not going to get hammered. What we are seeing as a legislative response is far, far different and much, much stronger.
Yeah, and I think that has unintended consequences, because as a lender, if you thought you knew the rules of engagement, and now you realize, wow, those can change at a whim of somebody other than a voter, a voting public, yeah, that gives you a little pause saying, I'm not sure I'll continue to do this.
Right.
So we have two pieces of legislation. I think I'll concentrate on 2501. There's a 828. First of all, have any of these passed, or are these just being contemplated?
Great question. And we can, you know, briefly even eliminate 828, because 828 is effectively folded into 2501. So There's this interesting question and dilemma right now, which is many states have either effective moratoriums or quasi-moratoriums on foreclosing on properties. When you look at California, there is no state requirement to or state prohibition in place stopping foreclosures from a purely legal perspective. There is a challenge right now that the way that our system works here in California is we have a non-judicial foreclosure process typically, which means that properties are sold at public auctions. And because we have these state lockdown orders in place right now, meaning that you're still not supposed to congregate in groups of 10 or more, and they never truly lifted that aspect of our lockdown, even though you're having restaurants and other aspects of our lives reopen, that particular order has never been lifted. So if you know, technically you and I are supposed to stay in our homes, we're not supposed to leave our homes, and we're definitely not supposed to congregate in large groups.
Okay.
So from a technical perspective, if we can't actually hold a public auction in California, some foreclosure trustees are continuing to do so, and I think at their own peril by doing it, until we can have somewhat larger gatherings, at least publicly sanctioned. So even though there's no technical law stopping a foreclosure from happening right now, I think there's a practical implication, meaning that if you did proceed with a foreclosure, you would have a borrower could likely make a claim against the lender about the validity of that foreclosure.
Okay.
So you have, you know, and up to this point, if you look at every, you know, kind of across the national landscape, you have executive orders, right? We're in an interesting place in which governors are kings, right? And they're making proclamations, and those proclamations have the full force and effect of law. And so they are effectively creating this nationwide patchwork of moratoriums around foreclosures. And that's kind of similar to what's happening in California. But the expectation is that the governors are now relaxing and starting to reopen the economy, and so that there will be somewhat of a vacuum or a void. And so now what you're seeing is the legislative bodies coming into play saying, well, we still need to protect these people, and what we're going to do is now legislate. Once that executive order disappears, we will create the legislative alternative to it.
Okay.
And that's what 828 and 2501 are. So 828, in its basic form, well, it's really two things. One, it's got a landlord-tenant component about the almost requirement to provide tenants some sort of forbearance. And it was interesting, I think if you've been watching this 828 or heard about it, there was a lot of really big associations. So, you know, for example, California Apartment Association and a lot of landlord-based associations. This was the bill, if you read in the news, that a judge could effectively reduce the rent by 25% if they found that the tenant had a need and that the landlord could sustain the loss. So this was the same legislation that had that component. In addition to landlord-tenant rights, they had a section in there that completely prohibited foreclosure activity at all in the state of California.
Correct.
Meaning you could not file a notice of default, you could not record a notice of sale, you could not hold a trustee sale. Zero activity was permissible for a 180-day period after, or whenever the legislation passed, and a 180-day period or six-month period until Newsom lifted the state of emergency related to COVID. That was 828. That same philosophy, dealing with foreclosure, all got dumped into 2501. So 2501 has the exact same prohibition that 828 did pertaining to foreclosure. So if 2501 passes, all-out prohibition on any foreclosure activity in the state of California. You can't record a notice of default, can't record a notice of sale, can't proceed to a trustee sale for the exact same time period, that 180-day period, until after Newsom lifts the state of emergency in California.
Now you said, did you say if it passed?
Yeah, thank you. Fair follow-up. So it is not passed. So right now, 828 appears to be dead in the water, and I think the reason why that's the case is because 2501 adopted this, you know, half of the same concept, it appears that 2501 is the one that has the momentum. And if you look at the bill's title, you know, it's the COVID Relief Act or whatever, you know, so this is the you know, the consumer protection that's coming out of COVID. And so 2501 has not passed. Right now, they've basically gone through the entire committee process on the assembly side. It should be getting, I believe the next stage here is that it will get an assembly vote, will then get debated in the Senate, and then it would have to go to the governor, of course. It is moving very quickly. So each week we basically have movement through the committees. It's passing through each stage of committee, but it's passing with opposition at each stage as well. So this is not a universal slam dunk head case. I believe the first vote was 12-7, and the next one was 9-3 or whatever. So there's clearly some opposition all along the way. The expectation is that there will be probably a lot of opposition in the Senate. I don't know whether it's enough to truly end the bill, but I suspect that it's not going to pass in its current form based on how onerous this bill really is.
Okay. Now, what if the state of emergency actually is over before this bill gets voted on? Does that mean it won't get considered, or that they'll just go to the 180-day period?
Great question. Yeah. So unfortunately, this bill would sunset 180 days after. So my sense is one, my practical sense is that Governor Newsom has no inclination to lift the state of emergency for some time. So this bill, if it passes, will pass well before then. And even if it does, most of the deadlines are triggered 6 months after it anyways. And so the bill as it's written doesn't necessarily, a lot of the key provisions are still enacted, even if the state of emergency is lifted.
So as I understand it, you can't start a foreclosure process. You have to freeze a foreclosure that's already in process. You cannot start an eviction. You can't proceed if an eviction was already in process. Is that accurate?
The eviction side, it's interesting enough about this bill, unlike 828, which had a lot of eviction-related remedies to it, this bill is really targeted at mortgage lenders instead. And so it's actually lenders of all stripes. They're in addition to mortgage lending, which is heavily discussed, there's also a lot of aspects that deal with vehicle repossessions and automobile lending as well as mobile homes. So this one is much more targeted to lenders rather than landlords. And it goes well beyond, unlike 828, which was kind of monofocused both on a landlord-tenant relationship as well as the foreclosure prohibition, 2501 is unprecedented, particularly in related to the requirements. So in addition to having this foreclosure moratorium, there is a mandatory forbearance, and that's where I've never expected to see anything of this grand scale. I don't think your average lender has any idea of how extreme this is quite yet, but and I can give you a really high level if you want. I don't want to steal your thunder from a question, so I'm jumping ahead. By all means, I can stop. But
no, that's perfect.
So here's where what is very interesting about 2501, because even if the foreclosure aspect of it, I think while it's onerous, and I think it's a deprivation of rights, particularly for these individual investors who have invested their savings over their life savings and these sorts of things, it's not ideal if you can't start a foreclosure or complete a foreclosure. You might go 6 months or a year or so without getting any ability to realize on your investment, and that is what it is, and that could really hurt a lot of people. But what's more interesting, and I think truly unprecedented, is that if a borrower contacts a lender during this time period and simply states to them, I am unable to pay my mortgage, if they make that statement to the lender and they attest to it, so they provide to the lender a statement in writing saying, I can't pay my payment, and they have zero obligation to provide any affirmative documentation. Whether it's true or not does not matter. As long as they put in writing that I cannot make my payments, the lender is obligated to cease requiring payments for a minimum of 6 months. And when that 6-month period ends, if the borrower comes back and says, I still can't make my payments, you are obligated to give them another 6 months of no payment. And so with zero proof, and to your point earlier, 90 to 95% of people are paying currently, right?
Yeah.
So just imagine if you were able to call it every, and this applies, the law applies to any single natural person who has a loan, could have been business, could have been rental property, could have been a spec home, a fix and flip project, doesn't matter. Makes no difference. If you call your lender and say, I can't pay, and I'm willing to sign something that says I can't pay, you can't look, you can't ask me for an additional piece of documentation. I don't have to prove anything. As long as I say I can't do it, you are forced to sit on the sideline for 1 year without a payment. And then and only then can you even look at a foreclosure option, assuming that the governor has lifted his order, of course, by that time.
Wow. Now, I did read the bill a couple of times, and I did that because you don't read that one time and catch a lot of it because it's difficult reading. But is it true that if it's a rental, they have to pass on the same forbearance to their tenant?
Yes. So the statute states that if it's a rental property and the landlord calls the lender and says, lender, I can't pay, the lender is obligated to give that landlord up to 1 year forbearance. If they provide it to the landlord, the landlord is then obligated to give the same forgiveness or forbearance to their tenant during that time period. But there is nothing the lender can do to require evidence that they've actually done that. It's just a requirement that with no enforcement of the landlord. So whether the landlord does it or not, who knows? But the party getting penalized is the lender if they don't offer. But whether the landlord does or not, they have an affirmative obligation, but there's no protection. You know, there's no regulatory oversight on that.
Wow. Now, for this 12-month period of no payments, you suffer no credit damage. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. So this is not, and that's where it gets really, you know. We have a societal problem, right? We have this really interesting issue, which is high unemployment. Some of that will necessarily be residual for some time. And so government is trying to figure out what do we do about this, right? How many people, what sort, are we going to kick some people out of their homes? What does that look like? And so in this effort, you're really seeing I would say that the farthest approach you can probably take is not only do they say, with the way that this bill is written to say is after that 1 year forbearance period, because this has always been one of the questions we've asked internally, is well, what happens then, right? The borrower hasn't paid for a year, and when we've been advising clients is we've said, well, what the responsible thing is some sort of catch-up period, right? Because presumably if the borrower had no ability to pay during your forbearance period, you know, it's unlikely they're suddenly sitting on a pile of cash after that 1 year period. You've got to be able to get them to work this thing back out. And so there should be some catch-up period where they're paying a little bit more than their traditional monthly payment and getting your loan caught up. Well, the way that this legislation is written is after that 1 year period, you as the lender are obligated to do one of two things. You either automatically extend this person's loan for the same amount of the forbearance period, right? So that's the catch-up period. Is there technically isn't one. You just continue paying the exact same payments. We simply add a year to your loan.
Right.
Which you can imagine. I would love to be a loan servicer trying to implement this, but that's a separate issue.
Okay. Well, I want to clarify what you just said. It's one thing to add a year to the loan. It's another thing to add a year's worth of interest to the loan. So which one is that?
It is there is no accumulation to it. So the way that it works is that you can add a year to the loan and whatever was cost. So let's say, for example, you've missed 1 year of payment. It's $1,000 a month payment. The way that this would be written is we extend your loan for one additional year and you continue to pay. And, you know, starting next month, you'll pay your $1,000 a month and we add 1 year to your loan and you'll pay $1,000 a month for that last year as well. So there's no default interest, no late charges, no penalty. Continue to pay your payment.
But not only that, what you've just said is that, let's say I have a 2 year loan and the first year goes on this moratorium and I have 1 year left and I have to extend it for a year. no matter how you look at it, I just got paid 2/3 of the payments I was intending that I was going to get. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. Correct.
And that's mandatory.
Or alternatively, you can recast.
Right.
And it's at the election of the borrower, of course. So the borrower can say, instead of adding a year to my loan, I actually just want you to take my new balance, so whatever my deferred amounts were, recapitalize my loan, and then re-spread it over the remainder of the term. Whatever the borrower would like to do, you must do. But those are your options after this 1 year program.
And if the borrower's demands, I just going to pay you, it was a 2 year loan. I was in trouble for the first year and I'll make payments on 2 years. Normally you're out the first year interest. That's the borrower's decision. The borrower's decision. That's not a debatable issue. Wow.
Not a debatable issue.
Well, see, that changes the rules of lending. That's a very scary thing.
It is truly I don't believe, you know, the California legislature they're trying to fix a problem. And I really don't want this to be a political or otherwise, because I don't think this is a well-intentioned thought process with absolutely no understanding of the consequences of what is happening. Because this may make sense and maybe it doesn't, right? I mean, if you're Bank of America, can you figure this out and sustain the loss? Probably. You can figure it out. It's going to be an absolute nightmare on the servicing side because, you know, someone once told me, and I think it's very true, you know, loan servicers do a great job when people make payments. Yeah. And when they don't, right, they fall apart. They weren't designed, they don't have the systems and processes for a large-scale default, and they don't work well when you're changing the terms of the loan. That's where loan servicing falls apart. But I can understand this for homeowners on a 30-year loan. This is probably the right solution for those homeowners. I don't think I agree with they should provide no documentation aspect. So, for example, we're the general counsel for American Association of Private Lenders, and we provided a form to the association that they provide freely to all of our members, which is a forbearance request form. Part of the form says, please explain your hardship. In the form of details, you know, to the degree you're claiming, you know, for example, if the rental property, to the degree you're claiming is a rental that your tenant isn't paying, please provide evidence, provide the bank statements, provide letters from your tenants, you know, otherwise, give us evidence that you're actually experiencing hardship, right? That makes practical sense. The circumstance here with the borrower has no obligation to provide anything or any evidence that they are actually affected. Is the absolute craziest component of what's happening here.
Yeah, that's like demanding a short sale just because I don't want to owe that much.
Yeah, 100%. No, 100%. I mean, it really is if this was only going to, all things being equal, this only going to apply to consumer loans, just the homeowners, you know, because we want to make sure that we don't have another 2008, I get it. I understand the legislative response. I think it's going to end poorly because I think you have so much, you know, institutional inefficiency and inability to manage this sort of default. When you're Wells Fargo, you got to deal with these issues. I get it. But you know what? The IRA investor who put $100,000 in a loan, how are they going to manage this? This is effectively a guarantee of no payment for at least a year, probably 2 years if you start really taking all these periods together. And just, you know, a complete stripping of rights related to that, right? The borrowers, it's really a crazy place in which, you know, people don't need them to pay their obligations.
Yeah, that's a bad thing to teach society, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also, let's say first of all, normally the lender and servicer are different companies. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. So, and it shows you the way that this bill was written. It was really, you know, if I were to give my wish list, this bill is very easy to modify that I think makes sense. The challenge you have here is really the definition of what is a borrower. A borrower in this context is a natural person, right? And when you look at the collateral definitions, it relates to 1 to 4 family properties. Well, there's a nuance because there's also, you could technically be a borrower of a multifamily property as well, asking for forbearance. But that is a very atypical definition of a borrower in California law or under federal law related to who are borrowers and what loans are we looking at here. There's almost always this definition that is also associated in there that the rules of these laws apply to loans which are primarily for personal, family, or household use. It's always the modifier you'll find in these laws. And that modifier, in my world, I would say, this law applies to a consumer loan, right? What is personal, family, household? It's a loan that was taken out for a consumer purpose. You're buying your primary residence, you're taking out money for tuition, you're doing a cash out refi on your home. All of those are consumer purposes. So that's normally how a law like this would be written. It doesn't have that modifier here. And similarly, when you ask about the question about servicer, it really entails in their mind, they are assuming these large consumer loans, because these large consumer loans are generally serviced by these very large loan servicers. And so they when you look through and parse the definition of servicer, it is either a third-party servicer or the lender if there is no third-party servicer.
The reason I asked that question is because the way I read the legislation is the servicer could do something wrong that could prevent the lender from being able to demand a payment or a payoff.
Yeah, that's right. And what's scarier, and another interesting thing too about the servicer side, so I was just reading it before our call, and here's a crazy, if you wanted a world that makes no sense, if that loan required impounds, right, for taxes and insurance, if during this forbearance period, you can't require they pay the impound payment. But here's where it gets better. The servicer is required to make those impound payments on behalf of the borrower during this 1 year period. And it gets better. Even after this forbearance period ends, the borrower in their election, as it relates to these impound payments that were made, they can either pay them back to the servicer over 5 years, or they can just, I'm not going to pay these back, just re-amortize it over my loan. So you've advanced dollars yesterday, but recast it over the remaining 25 years of my loan, and that's how I'm going to repay it back to you. At their election, again.
And no interest either, correct?
Yep, no interest, no fees, nothing on top.
This is the problem when you have people write laws that aren't in the business and don't understand the ramifications of things. Wow. Now, what voice does our industry have? Are we allowed to have a voice and say, you know, this is going to cause a lot more problems than you think, or do they care? Is this really just for a consumer benefit, and that's the way it goes?
You know, it's interesting. Normally, in a normal world, in our pre-COVID environment, if legislation like this were to ever try to come about, it, I think, would be pretty swiftly knocked down, because you'd have such concerted effort of every major financial organization. So, you know, National Mortgage Bankers Association, for us, California Mortgage Bankers Association, California Mortgage Association. You've got all these kind of institutions that really come, and they've got a strong voice, and they're always at the bargaining table. The challenge you have is that this is happening all across the country right now. And so, and there's plenty of right now that the sentiment is that those voices probably had a lot more power to them. But right now, I think the legislative bodies are, you know, they're looking at that at pitchforks, right? Is they're saying, if we know that if we have anything that even looks kind of like 2008, and we're kicking people out of their homes, that we're all losing our jobs, and you know, whatever societal upheaval that happens over, right? So this is a truly a response of trying to never make that same mistake again. But the challenge you have is that the legislatures are not, they're moving fast and without precision. I'm optimistic that I think these associations will be able to water, I don't know if water down is not even the right term, but really clarify who they should and shouldn't apply to. I think to me that probably and hopefully that if you could say that it's a victory, that's the end result, that this legislation is modified such that it doesn't apply to business purpose transactions. And that would really save the vast majority of these private investors and much more vulnerable populations, and still be able to keep the true intent of keeping homeowners in the home. You know, it really, you could have both. But there are advocates, right? So if you look, you know, CMBA has lobbyists, they are attacking this. California Mortgage Association has their own lobbyists, and they've got, you know, they're raising political action funds. And I'm happy to provide that link over to your audience if they want to participate, which we kind of recommend to people right now.
Okay.
If you want your voice heard. But you know, the challenge you have is those voices aren't going to get the same attention they would have before, because right now is you know, I think that the legislators believe they're going to come out as heroes, and we got those bad lenders, and all these lenders trying to take advantage of you. Don't worry, we have your back. Right? I mean, I think they come out with capes if it comes out and talk about their superhero status.
I've just got to ask maybe a silly question, but it a natural person, can you describe that? Is that a human with a pulse, or can that be an LLC?
Yeah, great. No, it's a good question. And oftentimes, you know, particularly in this world in which definitions don't line up to what they traditionally normally would have, I would read natural person to mean an individual. So if the, you know, hopefully a lot of private lenders making these business loans, oftentimes they're making them to LLCs or corporations or limited partnerships. And so they would not be covered as a borrower under the statute.
Wow. Well, that's very important to know.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
No, that's right.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked that. So if you're a hard money lender and you're lending to somebody that's borrowing in a name of an LLC, the legislation doesn't cover it. If they're borrowing in their own name, even though it's a rental property, it in fact could.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Wow. That's just really interesting. You know, I'm going to run a loan program by you, and I just want your opinion on it. Because one of the things our society it has a lot of upheaval right now, and I think it's partly because people don't feel like they have a shot at making progress. And there's talks about things like affordable housing. Well, About 3 years ago, we wrote a report. The title was 2% mortgage rates, $40 trillion in debt, and we're there. So we're going to get the $40 trillion in debt, but we also have a mortgage rate that starts with a 2 right now.
Yeah.
What would be wrong with a loan, a national loan that had one foreclosure process? So it would be an unusual product. And it would be, you have to qualify, but you don't have to have a down payment. So like a VA loan that's not connected to being a vet. And the reason that's typically dangerous is you're going to foreclose on a certain percentage of those loans. That's a given. But for just this program, okay, let's only hold a foreclosure sale for the back payments. So you have a mortgage rate that starts with a 2. You give somebody a shot at owning a home. 90% of them are successful. What that would do to our economy would make building explode in affordable areas. It would make people feel like they were part of, you know, what of the goodies. Their payment would be less than their rent, so they'd have extra money in their budget. And let's say the 10% that didn't make the payment. So let's be aggressive and say they're going to be 10% that don't. It goes to a trustee sale, and the opening bid is 6 months of a grand. Your opening bid is $6,000, buyable by anybody. An overbid goes to an insurance policy that covers the whole shooting match. To me, that's a brilliant time. It's a brilliant time to do that.
And you know, Bruce, the I think that's really the travesty of this, of what's happening, is that one, if you have mortgage lenders more flexible than I've ever seen them before, and I think for the, you know, and not by acknowledging what's happening in our society, I think that there is a forgiving attitude, and understanding that this is a unique situation that was not brought because you had a borrower who got themselves in over their head or otherwise. But you have a really a national sentiment of cooperation that hopefully lasts for some time, and maybe that's the one good thing that comes out of all of this. But to your point, is there are so many great ways to solve these sorts of problems, right? There are so many, rather than completely hammering one side with the assumption that these are bad actors or that they are, you know, that they're you know, going to take it, be predatory, take advantage. You know, there are so many things that we could be doing to really advance, because, you know, now I'll give you the practical side of this. When I'm counseling clients right now, they're now asking me, well, hey, if this thing passes, it looks like what I probably need to do is dramatically reduce my loan-to-value ratio, because I may not get a payment for a long time, and therefore I can't end up underwater in my lending. And in addition, I probably need to hold back the entire loan's worth of interest on the front end so that they can't default, because they could theoretically call up the next day telling me that they can't pay anymore and I would have to offer this to them. And the effect of those two things put together is less money going out there, right?
Yeah.
And a high restriction on the borrowing base that's available. So all it's going to do is massively restrict credit, right? That's the repercussion of this action. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And in the alternative, the win-win is how do you expand credit during this time period? Right, that is the ultimate way we get out of this. I'm personally not a huge fan of debt. I live a lifestyle that is almost completely devoid of debt. I don't believe in debt, oddly enough, for being an attorney that practices in finance. But that's how you light this engine back on fire, right? It's getting cheap debt out there is how we got out of the last recession.
Well, but giving people a chance at home ownership, I remember being the guy that was a renter. And this is a true story. You know, I was married at 17. I got fired 5 times in a row. Finally had a little can in the kitchen that I'd put 20 bucks in. I almost said 20 grand because the numbers have changed these days. But 20 bucks whenever I could. And I got 500 bucks together in 2 years. And we were able to take over a loan subject to. I didn't have to qualify for it. I just had 500 bucks, and it changed my whole life. That changed my whole life. And on the Saturday that we moved in, I mowed my own grass for the first time. And I honestly, I felt like a man. Felt like a man. I had joined society as a man. It had a very big impact on me. When you talk about affordable housing, that means governments write checks. We have affordable housing. It's in the payment.
Right.
So,
I think that's what really makes me sad about all of this, is that the lesson of this, or if this passes, the lesson of this is you don't need to be responsible for your obligations.
Yeah, that's
you
terrible.
Don't need to be sure. Right? That's what you... It's the exact inverse of what you just said, right? You saved up, you had an opportunity, and it taught you to be a responsible person because you had ownership in this thing. And this is the exact antithesis of this. This is a victim mentality of I can take advantage of somebody and I don't owe them anything and I have no responsibility. And it's just so, because... And that is the necessary repercussion of this. Is you take a citizenry who is otherwise responsible, right? Because if you know, even at a baseline, let's say we didn't change the business purpose or non-business purpose aspect. If at a minimum, the fact that this legislation was written purposely to not require any backup documentation, right, to not provide any proof that you really are experiencing a hardship, just shows at how fundamentally flawed the legislative analysis on this issue. Because if you're really trying to protect a homeowner, I get it. You want to, and if people are getting hardships, I get it. And you know what? reasonable people can disagree on the right policy on that. But to say that Bruce can call his lender tomorrow and say, I just don't feel like paying you, and that's okay, and that's what we're going to legislate, is that the society we want to live in?
No, and this is a progression, because it started with the payments. I mean, you had people not make payments last downturn, for 3 or 4 years? That was pretty common. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was sort of a lesson in, I didn't pay a price for it. Then it went to sort of student loan things, where how do we get out of this? So it's been a progression of, okay, how do we not pay what we signed up for? One of my favorite stories, guy that's a really great investor in California, was a pretty young man. This was 1990, a downturn in California, and he had a partner, and they owned a bunch of land funded by private money. And land just dove to zero, basically. And so Mike was contemplating what to do, and his partner, Mick Blackwell, took out the document and read to him what it said. And it said, "We promise to pay." Mm-hmm. Pretty cool, pretty cool lesson. And because there was no back door, there was only a way through. The hardest 18 months he ever worked, he solved all of that, paid all the people back and their interest. And it changed the course of his life, because he stood up to something that was really, really difficult. So that was... It's possible, and that's what you want to, you don't want to emerge. That's why I know, people that don't understand what causes losses, they think, nothing down, that's dangerous. So it's dangerous if it becomes an REO in mass. There's not one REO that would come about from this particular loan program, because it would be bought at the trustee sale for the opening bid of $6,000 or $8,000 by either another owner occupant, give them the first shot, I don't care, or a guy that wants a rental with a mortgage that starts with a 2. And you would make so many more people feel like they were part of the goodies. And in fact, they would be. They'd have a fixed rate loan. They'd have a loan that ultimately paid off. They'd have a beginning point where, in Florida, we have new houses that are worth $230. Put a 2.5% mortgage on that and compare that to rent. It's ridiculous.
That's right. No, you're absolutely right. And there are better ways to solve the problem, right? And I think that's the approach that's being taken is so ill-informed of what a good collaborator, this could be a great win-win, right? Yeah. You could really reshape our society for all the right reasons, and instead it's.
What's neat about this, the idea is you have a 30-year benefit for a window that's probably 12 months long.
That's right.
So... I just mentioned it to you because you're definitely a person of influence. I hope we can get an audience in front of somebody at some point that could really contemplate that and go, okay, it's going to seem politically incorrect in a way, nothing down, we're going to take some heat on that. But if they really understood, this is not how cause price damage. This is how you make America have equity and spendable money. It'd have a huge impact on our economy.
Right. No,
so,
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with him.
All right. Well, Nima, we are out of time. I've really enjoyed talking with you for the first time.
Yeah, same here, Bruce. Same here. What a world we live in. I hope you're doing well out there. I hope your audience is doing well. I mean, what a world, bud.
Yeah. You're talking about debt, and I realize, I'm very conservative too, but you realize that even though you think, okay, all my ducks are in a row, wow, all of a sudden, you realize there's some stuff that's changed that I would have never imagined.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a good lesson. All right, Nima, you have a great day. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.